Well, I'm very pleased that you actually came here this morning because, of course, we all have other things on our mind. And maybe I should take a break after a half hour and everyone, or 45 minutes, and everyone can go see what the latest news is.
Hopefully there won't be any
longer. Yeah, probably there won't be. You'll find out whether the airports are open again and whether you can get out of here. I'm going to talk about some very new results, sufficiently new that one slide was made yesterday. It was revised yesterday based on results that came in the day before, and more than half of it is not published, in fact, not written. So, no, I cannot give you a manuscript because it's only here. And another part of it did come out last year, and so I'm going to begin with that part, which is that the two subjects are regulation of transmitter release by neuromodulation and by homosynaptic plasticity, and the involvement of a presynaptic ion channel in both processes in a way that is completely unforeseen and still completely unexplained. So if someone could switch on the slide projector. All of this talk is based on experiments at the crayfish neuromuscular junction, and in particular it's the claw opener. That's the thing that does this, opens the dactyl of the claw. I actually work on the first walking leg. And so this is the motor neuron. There are two motor neurons, one exciter and one inhibitor, branching in this motor nerve. The exciter is a glutamatergic neuron, a fast...
Do you need the projector?
No, I don't need that. Sorry, I can get it. It's a fast glutamatergic motor neuron that excites all of the muscle fibers in this muscle, and the inhibitor is a GABAergic inhibitory motor neuron, also fast, that inhibits all of the muscle fibers in the muscle. So the muscle is the opener muscle, which actually opens the finger. The closer and the bottom of the claw have been cut away to expose the inner surface of the opener muscle, and there are actually terminals secreting transmitter right on the surface of the muscle, as well as underneath, wrapped around on the other side of the muscle fibers. Oops.
Does excitation and inhibition always happen at different times?
Well, they're different neurons, so it happens whenever they're active, which is not always at this different times, not necessarily. The kinds of experimental manipulations that we can do are to record simultaneously postsynaptically from a muscle fiber and presynaptically from a nerve branch, which is around 10 microns in diameter. These are unmyelinated neurons. So this is what crustaceans are all about. They have the largest unmyelinated motor neurons of any phylum. Freshwater crustaceans have a less sheath, and crayfish are among the biggest freshwater crustaceans. That's why. And they're also edible. The other thing we can do is either by ionophoresis or by pressure, we can inject substances into the presynaptic neuron very close to some nerve terminals. And in addition to the electrophysiology and the capability of having some biochemical access to the presynaptic terminals, we can place a lens right above some of these boutons, near where we're recording from and near where we can inject things. And we can, among other things, inject a fluorescent dye, for example, and record changes in ion concentration in nerve branches or presynaptic boutons, actual boutons on a muscle fiber. And we can put our postsynaptic electrode in that same muscle fiber that receives and responds to transmitter released by those boutons that we're imaging. Of course, we're not imaging all the boutons onto the muscle fiber, just some of them. So, just to give you an idea what a real preparation looks like, here are a cluster of boutons. This is at low magnification. At high magnification, you'd see a bunch of little circles. In this case...
Are where in the muscle?
No, these are presynaptic nerve terminals, boutons. And so they're on the surface of the muscle. The end, you know that nerves release transmitter at synapses. And good. That's what... Bouton, okay. We would be imaging, for example, these boutons. The dye here is a fura, which is a fluorescent dye, which is sensitive to calcium changes. And then we could have a postsynaptic... This was, muscle fiber is about this big here. And so we would have a postsynaptic electrode in this muscle fiber at the same time that we're recording presynaptically, electrically, as well as imaging changes in, for instance, ion concentration.
So there's actually a process from that neuron that goes down there?
Well, these are all processes of one neuron, all of these things, because the dye has been injected into one cell in the sheath. And so it looks... No, you inject it there, and it diffuses everywhere. It's actually not diffusion, it's pressure injection. Well, if it's pure, it's ionophoresis, and then it diffuses. If it's something else that's not charged, you can't ionophorese it, so you pressure inject it, and you really just pump up the neuron. So we co-inject substances like enzymes with dyes, and we can just see. We go, and the thing fills up with color. And by measuring the dye concentration, we can estimate the concentration of whatever else we put in there with it, assuming they all... I mean, this isn't diffusion, so we're just assuming that they all move together within the balloon, which is, I think, safe. Okay. So that's the preparation. So the first part of the talk has to do with neuromodulation. And in particular, this synapse, this neuromuscular junction, which remember is a glutamate synapse, is sensitive to serotonin. So serotonin is a hormone in crayfish. There are no serotonergic neurons going out to the muscle. So there's no serotonin released locally. But you can collect it in the blood, and it goes up and down depending on the state of arousal of the animal, and it goes down to less than 100 nanomoles and up to a micromole. So this is what the neuromuscular junction is normally subjected to in the life of the animal. So if you take something like a micromole, and actually a couple hundred nanomoles is perfectly sufficient, and put it in the bath, of course in the bath you wash out all the serotonin that might be there, so now it's down to zero, and then you put back what you want. You see that this is a postsynaptic potential recorded from the muscle fiber, and it can get here, it's about three times bigger. And also the mini frequency, the spontaneous release of iguana, increases about threefold. So there's...
Is this an individual PTSP or another?
I don't remember. this particular example, I honestly don't remember. I mean, it's big enough that you don't have to average it, but we usually average it. What you can see here is that there's no change in apparent size of minis, and in fact there really is no change at all in the average size of minis while the frequency goes up. This is percent change, and this is a histogram of intervals. So the intervals get shorter, which means the frequency goes up.
Are they failures?
Are they what?
Are they failures?
These are spontaneous releases, so you can't talk about a failure of a spontaneous release.
Maybe I did something, but the body says that the serotonin enhances the quantum content.
Yes. So the size of the quantum is unchanged. The frequency of spontaneous release is increased, and people have done, and in fact, well, I haven't. Others have done a statistical analysis of fluctuations. There's unquestionably an increase in the number of quanta released while no change in the size at all. It's totally presynaptic.
The quantum content is the number of quanta, but not the size of the quanta, each quanta.
Yeah, that's the standard terminology since cats. Well, I don't want to say Katz was stupid and I'm going to change all the words. So I'm just going to use the same terminology that everyone uses in this field. Quantal content means the number of quanta. And quantal size means the amplitude. This is sort of standard terminology. I'm just adopting the usual nomenclature. So this was done in 1980 by Ed Kravitz and colleagues at Harvard. This is old stuff. Although these are our records, you can see I probably got this record 10 years ago, and that's why I can't remember whether I averaged it or not. So this is the one phenomenon we want to explain, the increase in strength of synaptic transmission caused by a circulating hormone. So the first thing is it seems to involve cyclic AMP elevation, in part. So a maximal dose, actually, of serotonin gives about a four-fold increase. And these are averaged responses, so you can see standard error bars, thin little bars on here. So this is the average of several preparations. About a four or five-fold increase in EPSP size, while forskolin, which activates adenylate cyclase and produces cyclic AMP, at maximal dose only produces about half as big a response. So this is one of several pieces of evidence that indicate that serotonin works by two actions. Half of it is mimicked by a rise in cyclic AMP. And most of the experiments I'm going to show you use forskolin rather than serotonin, because the other half of it we don't understand at all. And I can tell you all the things it's not, but you don't want to hear that. Or you can ask me about what are all the things it's not. But, I mean, it's not CAM kinase, it's not PKC, and it's...
Does it involve PKM?
No. So it's not anything anybody could think of. But this is the part we're interested in. Another indication that the production of cyclic AMP is involved in at least part of serotonin's action is that the serotonin effect can be enhanced by IBMX. So IBMX is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor which prevents the breakdown of cyclic AMP. So if cyclic AMP is produced by serotonin, IBMX should enhance the response, and it does. By itself, IBMX does nothing to EPSPs. So, I don't have that control here. So we're going to talk about, only the cyclic AMP part of serotonin's action. So the most likely target for cyclic AMP is cyclic AMP-dependent kinase. Every textbook in biology will tell you that. And here are two of three inhibitors that we've used for PKA, protein kinase A or cyclic AMP-dependent kinase. H7, which is a broad-spectrum inhibitor, RP8-bromocyclic AMPS, which is a cyclic AMP analog which acts as an inhibitor at the kinase. And the third one, which is not on here, has got a bunch of numbers that I never can remember. Well, it'll show up on a later slide, KT something or other. Anyway, all three inhibitors at rather excessive doses have no effect on the response. The response has not been blocked, not been blocked, not been blocked. But this one is very interesting. This one by itself looks like a weak agonist. This should be an inhibitor, should do nothing to EPSPs, and yet not only does it not inhibit the 5-HT response, but it alone causes an increase, and in these experiments an even bigger, a similar increase to about 150% in the size of the EPSP. So why would an inhibitor first fail to inhibit, instead act as a weak agonist? Well, it turns out that there is another target for cyclic AMP. And that's what I like to call the HCN channel, which stands for hyperpolarization and cyclic nucleotide activated channel. So it's even named after the fact that it's activated by cyclic nucleotides. And it's related to olfactory channels in olfactory neurons. And of course, you probably all know that in the retina, cyclic GMP activates channels. So there are another, those channels are all related, and this is a channel which is very first discovered in the heart. It is the main target for adrenaline and acetylcholine regulation of heartbeat. It's therefore clinically very important. It's a pacemaker current that is partly responsible for setting the repetitive activity in heart rate. It's also present in thalamic neurons, and especially in thalamic neurons, which are rhythmically active, and blocking this channel blocks their rhythmic activity. So it is a very important muscle and nerve channel. And it's activated by two things. Hyperpolarization, that's the opposite of all other channels, and cyclic nucleotides, and therefore it's called HCN. So this is a channel, this is a target that is known to be activated by this particular substance. And so we had to suspect that such a channel might be somehow at least involved in this thing here. So we first asked, is there any evidence for the presence of such a channel? So first, this channel, which is activated by hyperpolarization, is a cation channel. It lets sodium and potassium pass. It's got an equilibrium potential of about minus 25 or minus 30 millivolts. So when the channel is opened, it depolarizes the cell. So people are always confused at this. I thought you said it was a hyperpolarizing channel. No, hyperpolarization activates it. But when it's active, it depolarizes because...
Isn't something like IH? It is IH?
It's the same as IH. I used to call it IH. But since we use cyclic nucleotides to activate it, I like HCN better. Because that... And anyhow, that's the modern term, HCN. The molecular biologists all call it HCN, and the physiologists all call it IH. It's exactly the, so that it's the same channel. That's actually, there are four members of this channel that are known, and they have different sensitivity to cyclic nucleotides, and that's in vertebrates, and I don't know which one this is, or if it's a different one in crayfish. So the first clue that such a channel is present is that presynaptically, serotonin or forskolin causes a depolarization. A depolarization, this is about 10 millivolts. This altogether is 30 millivolts presynaptically, so that's about 10 or 12 millivolts. So you not only have an enhancement of transmission, which is the postsynaptic potential here, but you have a presynaptic depolarization. So that's what happens when you activate this channel, is you depolarize the membrane. But the real signature of this channel is that it's activated by hyperpolarization and it has very slow kinetics. So if you pass hyperpolarizing current through your presynaptic electrode, you get a depolarizing after potential because you activated the channel, which closes only very slowly. This is 2 seconds here. So it's got very slow relaxation. It's a depolarizing current. It's activated by hyperpolarization. And it's blocked by, this is the effect of various magnitudes of current. And anything up to about 30 nanoamps of current is blocked by ZD7288 or by cesium in, at the appropriate concentrations. So these are about 10 times the KDs of cesium in mammals and ZD7288 in mammals in blocking this channel. In other words, it should just about completely block it. And you block everything except what you get at very high hyperpolarization when you probably start to get membrane breakdown. This is well known. If you hyperpolarize by too much, the cell falls apart. And you can't block that by any drugs. But this stuff is blocked. So it's got the right kinetics. It goes in the right direction. It's activated by hyperpolarization. It's got the right pharmacology. There are apparently IH or HCN channels at presynaptic nerve terminals or at least preterminal axons, which is where the electrode is. And the electrode is actually only about a fifth of a length constant from the nearest terminals, the terminals that release transmitter that we record. Okay, so we're close, electrically close, to the terminals that are responsible for the synapses that we're studying. Okay, in addition to that, serotonin, which depolarizes nerve terminals, that depolarization is counteracted by increasing doses of cesium or by increasing doses of ZD7288. So cesium at this concentration of a, it's got a KD of about 250 micromole, it doesn't have much effect on other ion channels. But the really important drug is ZD7288, which at any dose is not known to affect any other channel, at any dose. While we all know that a mole cesium is likely to cause troubles. So this is a highly specific blocker, and it's at exactly the right KD. 6 micromoles is reducing to half the depolarization caused presynaptically by either serotonin or forskolin. So that depolarization is caused by the activation of these channels. It's not caused by hyperpolarization triggering it. It's caused by, there is no hyperpolarization. There's simply a direct depolarization. It's the cyclic AMP that's being produced, that especially by forskolin, which triggers it.
So depolarization independently activates it, or
no? Hyperpolarization activates it.
Independently activates.
Yeah.
Or does it activate it through some cascade that is the same cascade as the.
You don't. No. It works. I mean, what it essentially does is it shifts the cyclic AMP dependence, but it means that if there's no cyclic AMP, so the curve is shifted to below zero, to negative concentrations if you want. In other words, you don't need any cyclic AMP, for instance, in excise patches if you hyperpolarize. So there really is a voltage sensor there.
So cyclic AMP actually shifts the other way, voltage dependence. Then that voltage dependent curve would shift the right way.
Well, it would shift to the left. I usually do depolarization on the right and hyperpolarization on the left, so it would shift it. The depolarization shifts. You can say cyclic. You have a two-dimensional plot of response versus cyclic. I mean, I don't want to try and draw a two-dimensional plot on the blackboard if you don't mind.
But you just draw the same activation curve, the voltage.
And then add cyclic AMP? I mean, right. So you can say cyclic AMP shifts the voltage curve, or you can say voltage shifts the cyclic AMP curve. It doesn't matter, because you just cut the two-dimensional space this way or that way. But either way, since you have a two-dimensional space, if you cut it the right way, it appears as if voltage shifts the cyclic AMP dependence. Okay.
About time.
I don't remember if there's a change in time constant. The time constant is voltage sensitive, but I don't remember if cyclic AMP changes the time constant. But I'm not sure.
How do you localize those channels?
Very good question. I don't know. Here's what we tried. There's an antibody made so far to one of the four members of this HCN family, and that antibody doesn't bind to ground up crayfish nervous system in a Western blot, so I guess that's not going to help us any. Anyhow, it's a crayfish, and the antibody came from a mammal, and you know, who's to say that it's going to bind, that region of the protein is exactly the same. So we can't localize it that way. It's generating a current in a nearly isopotential, you know, it's a nerve branch which has short or long length constants and therefore short length distances. So you can't tell how near or far you are. Is it right under your electrode or a few microns away? And that's you'll see in a minute that that's a problem. The channels are there, they are activated by serotonin, and they're also activated by forskolin. Here's the presynaptic membrane potential depolarized by forskolin. That effect is blocked by cesium, and then if you take the cesium away, forskolin now has an effect. Here again is forskolin, and then if you add ZD7288 and you wash out the forskolin, the response disappears, and forskolin now second time doesn't do anything. So it's clear that cyclic AMP generation activates this channel presynaptically, and that effect is blocked by the usual blockers. So what does this have to do with synaptic transmission? Well, we can look at the time course of serotonin's action on synaptic transmission, which is the black circles, and then when you wash out the serotonin, the response recovers usually in 10 or 15 minutes or 20 minutes at most. And at the effect on the membrane potential, which is a sign of the activation of the IH channel, and they're very similar. So it's certainly possible that activation of this channel underlies the increase in synaptic transmission, and to our surprise, it's actually true. So ZD7288 blocks the Forskolin response by about 80%. And it also blocks the response to 8-bromocyclic AMP. This is not cyclic AMPS, right? So this is a cyclic AMP analog that activates the channel. 8-bromocyclic AMPS blocks actually that's RP camps, is another weak activator. This is a strong activator of the channel. It's known to be a strong activator of the channel, and you get a big response, and that's reduced by this drug, again, by about 75%. Serotonin's response is only dropped to half, and that's consistent with the idea that serotonin works by two pathways, one of which is this one, and the other is a complete mystery. And that's either using cesium or ZD7288. Barium doesn't do anything, and it shouldn't do anything. It's not a blocker of this channel. Okay. So that means that activation of this presynaptic ion channel is responsible for modulation of synaptic transmission. So the here's another blocker that we just started using. DKAH269 is known to be a use-dependent blocker of IH channels. If you add the drug first, and then depolarize, or sorry, then hyperpolarize. This is kind of out of focus. This is the increasing concentration of the drug, and this is the block in the depolarizing ether potential that you get. If the drug is pre-applied, it takes a higher concentration than if it's applied after the channel has first been opened. This is the sign of a use-dependent drug. It's a use-dependent blocker. So this is pre-applied, right? Is that right? This may be backwards. Post-applied should be more effective because the channel's already open. So it's known to be a use-dependent blocker of this channel, and here's a Forskolin response, and here's a Forskolin response in the presence of this drug. And you can see again that the response is reduced. This is the enhancement of synaptic transmission. And if it's true that activation of this channel underlies an increase in synaptic transmission, and that the channel in this case is activated by serotonin and cyclic AMP, we can also activate it by hyperpolarization, and we might get the same effect. So we do this by just passing hyperpolarizing current, a modest current that should hyperpolarize by about 15 millivolts presynaptically for about a minute, and the PSPs get bigger. This is the hyperpolarization occurs during this time, and you have a growth over the next few minutes of the PSPs, which probably is recovering. That effect is blocked by ZD7288. So you can also enhance synaptic transmission by presynaptic hyperpolarization implied artificially.
So you do it right at the presynaptic terminal?
Well, we do it where our electrode is, but it's within a fraction of a length constant of the terminals that whose release we're studying.
So if you go farther, you see how it's...
Well, we haven't tried that because I think it would teach us cable theory. Or something. I'm not sure what it would teach us. We don't know how long the cyclic AMP remains up. In fact, that's something we want to look at with flicker, which is a fluorescent compound that can be used to measure cyclic AMP concentration. So we imagine that the cyclic AMP stays high for a few minutes. and that this reflects the cyclic AMP concentration, but that's just a guess. So now the question is, how does it work? How does activation of an ion channel influence synaptic transmission? So the first thing is, well, it causes the depolarization. What happens if you just depolarize nerves? So if you just pass current, you can either do it, in this case, actually we've repeated the experiments, but I think Voidovich and Atwood, who spent a year doing these experiments, have better data than ours. And it seems stupid to spend another year just to get data as good as theirs, so I'm showing you their data. They depolarize the nerve terminal.
Just a minute, step back a second. This is a bit confusing. So before you said you hyperpolarize, right?
Yeah. The hyperpolarization opens the channel.
Opens the channel. So you briefly hyperpolarize, and then
that's how we proved that the channel was there. But the way it's activated is by cyclic AMP going up.
No, but before you... After you said the cyclic AMP, didn't you say that you...
Well, I also hyperpolarized it to activate it, yes.
But
the question is, how does it affect transmitter release?
I'm just trying to get the fact, and before I'm trying to understand how it happened, I'm just trying to... Because it's a bit confusing, this hyper-depolarization of this channel.
Well, in the experiments in which I tried to activate it electrically, I hyperpolarized it. So. That's why I like HCN. See, always remember it's an HCN channel. So there are two ways to activate it, H and CN. I can choose whichever one I want. But it's a depolarizing channel. It causes depolarization.
What happens is when you hyperpolarize it, you're bypassing its effect of depolarizing.
Well, you're passing a hyperpolarizing current. I mean, I could draw an equivalent circuit. The reason you have a depolarization is you've activated a conductance. The reason you have a hyperpolarization is you're passing a current by pushing and turning a knob.
Just looking at hyperpolarization...
Well, during the time that I'm hyperpolarizing, and I'm getting a net hyperpolarization.
So during that time, you get hyperpolarization and net increase in synaptic transmission?
No, it's afterwards.
Oh, okay.
The hyperpolarization, this is minutes.
That's what I meant.
Hyperpolarization is for 1 minute. A minute.
Okay.
Some people say that's a long time, people who work in milliseconds.
When you're doing
anyhow, a minute.
The cell is already depolarized.
Yeah, but from this, well, it's depolarized basically for a few seconds after the end of passing this current.
All right.
Because then you stop passing.
This effect is much longer.
Yeah, because then the channel closes, and it closes, it relaxes with a time constant of about a second. But that's in this experiment. Cyclic AMP, there's no hyperpolarization anywhere. You just get a depolarization throughout the whole time of the cyclic AMP. Which you...
Because in memory, the H current is slow in hyperpolarizing voltage, but it's fast when the voltage is not in the polarizing.
I haven't checked. I haven't studied its kinetic behavior. You saw its relaxation at near rest.
But this time course is not regaining kinetics.
This is the effect on synaptic transmission. Percent increase in EJP amplitude. It's got absolutely nothing to do with the kinetics of the channel. The kinetics of the channel, I mean, the channel is open while I'm passing current and for a second or two afterwards, and that's it. But in all the experiments except this one, all the other experiments, there's no hyperpolarization, and all the effects of serotonin and forskolin, there's only a depolarization, and it lasts for as long as the drug is present, plus a few minutes afterwards.
Yeah, but you said that you now want to test if depolarization per se is enough, so that's why there was a question. But
right.
You have depolarization here. You say there
It could be, but it's pretty unlikely. So this already suggests that it's hard to believe that the depolarization itself is involved. But the fact is, if you depolarize nerve terminals from the rest, which is about 70, minus 70 millivolts, to minus 60, you get a tiny, 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 tiny effect. And in order to get the postsynaptic response to get much bigger than it normally is, you have to depolarize by at least 15 millivolts. So it's more than what we've ever seen happen. So in other words, you can increase transmitter release by depolarizing the nerve terminal, but you have to depolarize much more than happens here. And that effect is due to the opening of calcium channels. And calcium comes in, and you can measure it. So we think that the polarization that we observe is too small to directly cause anything like the large increase in synaptic transmission that we observe.
The increase of the synaptic transmission which you observe is after the end of hyperpolarization or signal.
Well, in this one experiment, it's after the end of the 1 minute of hyperpolarization. So this is the time, and that's minutes, and the hyperpolarization lasts for 1 minute, which is about the thickness of two dots.
Because you probably don't have synaptic transmission during hyperpolarization.
Yeah, we do. There it is. We're stimulating the action potentials. That's how you measure it. These are responses to action potentials. Well, you still can have action potentials while you're hyperpolarizing. This is what happens to the presynaptic membrane potentials. You have a spike, and then I pass current, and I hyperpolarize, but then you still have a spike. That's not hypothetical. That's what the electrode shows. Okay. So the spike is triggered by, two electrodes fall down in the axon a couple centimeters away. A standard propagated action potential. So, anyhow, we don't think that the depolarization that normally accompanies serotonin action is sufficient to be responsible for the effect. In fact, in many of our later experiments, our resting potential is minus 75 millivolts, and therefore we're only and serotonin then depolarizes from here to here, which just doesn't do anything. The next thing is maybe we are somehow modulating calcium channels so that during action potentials more calcium comes in. So it is possible to voltage clamp presynaptic nerve terminals in crayfish, but it's very hard, and we haven't succeeded in doing it, but Lin and Vyshevsky have, and have studied it, but they haven't looked at the effect of serotonin. You have to get two electrodes into a 10 micron axon next to each other, and then you have space clamp problems. It's not perfect. But at any rate, what you can do is you can measure to a train of action potentials the rise in presynaptic calcium using Fura. So this is the change in presynaptic calcium concentration to a train of action potentials. Beat, beat, beat. Now we add serotonin and we ask, are we increasing calcium influx? And the answer is no. In fact, if anything, it decreases very slightly. And then we go back. It's more or less the effect, which is completely non-significant, is also reversible. And you might say, well, wait a minute. How much of a change in calcium would you need to cause the increase in synaptic transmission? Remember, synaptic transmission is very non-linearly dependent on calcium. So you don't have to double the calcium influx or the calcium concentration to double synaptic transmission. Well, actually, if you go from a 50% calcium medium to 100% calcium medium, you get a small increase, about a 20% or 25% increase in calcium concentration inside. And the reason is the calcium channels saturate. 100% in crayfish is 13 millimoles. 50% is 6.5 millimoles. So from going to 6.5 millimoles to 13 millimoles, that's half normal to normal, you only get about a 20% increase in calcium influx. But that 20% increase in calcium influx mimics the effect of serotonin. It doubles the PSP. So this is how much calcium would have to increase if this were responsible for it. And it doesn't increase by that amount at all. It decreases. So this mechanism of increased calcium influx is not what serotonin's doing. It's doing something else. So it's not depolarization, it's not an activation of calcium channels. Another possibility was suggested by old results that are illustrated here. This is a tetanus that generates post-tetanic, well, generates facilitation, augmentation, and post-tetanic potentiation. You've probably heard about these synaptic plasticities. So all of that's happening during the tetanus, and it's completely off scale way up here. Big PSPs, very big in crayfish, 50 times normal. So I like crayfish. See, you don't talk about 100% change. You talk about a 5,000% change, and that's significant. So then at the end of the tetanus, where the PSPs are 50 times bigger, so they're off scale here, we're looking at the testing at different times after the end of the tetanus. This is the recovery from facilitation, the recovery from augmentation, and this is post-tetanic potentiation in this period. These are seconds. And you can see that the jagged line are the plus and minus one standard error of the EPSPs. In other words, they all fall, by and large, within these two lines. The EPSP amplitude is recovering to where it started. And the presynaptic calcium is also recovering. So there is a residual calcium following a lot of activity, which correlates with post-tetanic potentiation. And it actually causes it. The way we know it causes it, and this is a completely different talk, so I didn't bring any of the slides. I'm just going to remind you of some old results. You can, at this point in time, release a caged BAPTA. Flash a light and release a photosensitive caged BAPTA. This will suddenly drop the residual calcium to near its normal level. And when you do that, PTP disappears within a second. So therefore, PTP is caused by that calcium, because when you take it away, the PTP goes away. So the question is the same thing happening with serotonin? Is the IH channel somehow, for instance, letting calcium in, maybe this much calcium? If it lets in, well, so how much calcium does it have to let in? So the answer is, what you have is, this is about 0.3 or something like that, or 0.4 millivolts. So for about a 10-fold change in EPSP amplitude, you need about a micromole change in calcium concentration. This is actually change in calcium. Or for a 2-fold change in PSP, you need about 200 nanomoles. So the question is that what's happening? Maybe IH channels let calcium in. Well, they do let calcium in, but not enough, and in the wrong place. So serotonin and forskolin can increase the calcium concentration by about 40, in this case 60 nanomoles. On the average, it's about 45 nanomoles. And 45 nanomoles is about a quarter or a fifth as much as you'd need to account for the increase in synaptic transmission of at least a doubling. The second thing is it's in the wrong place. We can only detect this in preterminal axons, never in the bouton itself. That's probably because the bouton is known to have very high calcium buffering, a buffer ratio of 500 to 1, unlike most axons, which is 100 to 1, and very strong pumping. There are pumps in the boutons that aren't in the axon. So if a little calcium leaks into the bouton, it's just going to be controlled to a level that we can hardly detect it, and that's certainly true. We cannot detect it. While in the axon, where there's less buffering and less pumping, you might expect to see a rise in calcium, and we do. But it's in the wrong place, and it's not enough. And it is through IH channels, because the only calcium channel present is P-type calcium channel. So omega agatoxin blocks all of the calcium rise during action potentials, all of it, and yet it has no effect on the calcium rise to serotonin or forskolin. So this is before and after agatoxin. There's not a significant difference there. So IH channels, which are non-specific cation channels that are known to pass sodium and potassium, also let in a little calcium, but it's not enough, and it's in the wrong place. So, and this is relevant to the question of where are the IH channels. No. We imagine that the IH channels are in the nerve terminals because they're affecting transmitter release, but we can't prove that.
But But you measure locally the calcium, so can you see the very places where you...
Well, but it's a tiny little trickle of calcium occurring over a long time, so you can't, it's going to diffuse, and if there's a strong pump and a strong buffer in one area, then it will be lower in that area. And we know there's a strong pump and a strong buffer in the boutons, and we know that it's not in the axons, and so it's lower there. And it would be lower there whether it started from there or diffused to there.
Can you explain how you measure calcium?
With Fura. Does everyone know how to measure calcium with Fura? No, okay. I should explain that. Fura is a calcium-sensitive dye. It's fluorescent, so it binds calcium. And it's always fluorescent. It's actually tricky. And it's always fluorescent at a yellow color. So the color doesn't change. And what changes is the ability to excite it. So you have to excite it at two different wavelengths. And one wavelength is better excited if it's low calcium, and the other is better excited if it's bound to calcium. So you look at the fluorescence ratio when you excite at two different wavelengths. And that ratio is a direct measure of calcium. And then you convert the ratio to a color, and you make a beautiful colored picture, which is completely unreal, but is beautiful. Corresponds to absolutely nothing, but is wonderful. We think we can detect the 10 to 20 nanomoles, definitely 20 nanomoles, 10, no. So the thing is, we're talking about 30, and we're about two or three times the detection threshold, which means in the boutons, we're probably just missing it, but who knows.
Now, pure itself is calcium buffer. Right.
Yeah, so you don't put much in. Well, you can look at the effect of transients as a function of pure concentration, and we make sure we use a small enough amount that it has less than a 20% effect on any transient we measure. And basically, what you're doing is extrapolating the effect as a function of pure concentration, and then you extrapolate it to zero. And we're working at something that has up to 20% reduction, which means we're increasing the buffer ratio by up to 20% over what it normally is by adding this extra buffer. So it is a perturbation. Okay. So another thing that one can do is add a buffer, deliberately add an extra buffer. And what you people will have no trouble understanding is this slide, which is what is the most difficult slide for biologists. And that is...
Do you want to explain it to me?
So you have, basically, this is the behavior of calcium in a well-stirred medium, where calcium is regulated by a pump, so that means the calcium is reduced as the pump increases, that's the negative sign, and by an influx. Okay, so the pump is multiplied, this is the pump per unit area, has to be multiplied by the area, and the pump is assumed to act as a function of calcium linearly. Actually, it doesn't even have to be linear, so it can be a saturating pump. And likewise, there's an influx per unit area times the area. This is a leak. This is what we think is turned on by serotonin, some influx. But if there's a higher buffer present, then less calcium will be free. This is what comes in, but what's free is only 1% of that, or if it's a buffer ratio of 100 to 1. Or in our case, in the nerve terminals, Dave Tank has measured it at about 500 to 1, which means only 0.2% of the calcium is free. So this is about 500. But we can increase this by injecting EGTA. So that's the calcium buffer ratio, which depends on all the buffers present, including any that we add. And it can be a saturable buffer, and just like this can be a saturable pump. But whether the pump and the buffer are saturable or not, the important thing here is the steady state level of calcium that you get when you turn on an influx is independent of the buffer ratio. Okay, the steady state level, that's this is equal to zero, the betas cancel out, and the calcium is equal to I over P, the influx divided by the pump rate. All the buffer ratio does is change the time constant at which you approach steady state. So this is obvious to people who have played around with one compartment models, but hardly obvious to anyone else who always imagines that if you fill a cell with EGTA, you will make the calcium transient smaller. Everyone says that. Smaller. Wrong. Slower. Yes. Smaller. No. Slower. Yes. Smaller. No.
Well, if you have IA, which is short, then it will affect
you. Oh, if it's an impulse, smaller. Yes, then it's quite different. Right, because then it doesn't reach, but this is only steady state. Only steady state. So, we are certainly dealing with steady state this last 4 minutes. Here's what we do. When we add EGTA, we inject EGTA, as well as a little bit of Fura, but we're injecting EGTA, or BAPTA actually, BAPTA. We slow the calcium rise, which is measured with the Fura. It reaches about the same level, but it takes almost twice as long to get there. In fact, it reaches a peak after the transmitter release has reached a peak. And we haven't had any effect on the transmitter release. So now the cause follows the effect, which is not good. It's not the cause. Okay, the calcium rise can't be the cause. So this again is a very tiny calcium rise. Here it is, 35 to 40 nanomoles, very tiny calcium rise. But we can have effects on synaptic transmission. It's reduced to less than half, and synaptic facilitation, which is due to the accumulation of calcium, and here it has not reached steady state, and you can see we're slowing the accumulation of calcium. These are effects that are known to be due to residual calcium, and they do respond in the expected way to BAPTA, but here there's no effect at all on BAPTA on the magnitude or time course of the Forskalin response. So we think it has nothing to do with that tiny little calcium, which is too little coming in the wrong place. So we have a clue. Actually, I'll give you some more negative results. Well, I'll give you the positive one first because that suggested the negative ones. One clue is that the cytoskeleton is important for serotonin or Forskalin action. Three different inhibitors of actin, and these are actin depolymerizers, and they don't do anything else, but these are all three of them, swinolide A, latrunculin B, and cytochalase D, and if anyone can find something that's a C, I'll try that too, but I don't know of anything, all cause a major 75 to 90% reduction in serotonin's effect, or Forskalin's effect. In this case, we're looking at Forskalin. But other cytoskeletal inhibitors, like nocotrizol, which disrupts tubulin, don't do anything. ML7 is myosin light chain kinase inhibitor, doesn't do anything. I already showed you BAPTA doesn't do anything. Here's CAM kinase inhibitor, doesn't do anything. Neither do protein synthesis inhibitors. Cyclohexamide didn't do anything, and isoniazid gave a non-significant increase, grafelbin A a non-significant decrease. In general, there are no effects. So we have one class of drugs, but it's the whole class, that interfere with this synaptic enhancement. Here's a reduction in cytochalasin, here's a reduction in latrunculin, and this one must be swinolide A. So the cytoskeleton is in some way involved. And actually two of these drugs, latrunculin B and swinolide A, which isn't shown here, have no effect on IH. IH is still activated, but its activation no longer increases synaptic transmission. But the third one, cytochalasin, also causes a reduction in IH activation. And this is sort of nasty thing about actin depolymerizers that has been observed before. Different ones sometimes have different effects, which is why we try it every one we can get our hands on. So they all block synaptic transmission enhancement. They all have no effect on baseline transmission. They also don't affect facilitation or potentiation. They just affect the Forskalin response. And two of them have no effect on IH activation, while one of them seems to affect IH activation too. Okay, so actin is always being assembled at one end and depolymerized at another end. It's in a dynamic state of assembly and disassembly. And all of that is frozen, and in these presence of these depolymerizers, and then actin slowly starts to disassemble and disorganize in their presence.
What is the role of actin in this application?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. And I... Ah, yes. Okay, there is another section that I stuck in since I thought I was going to have an hour and a half, which I may still have. What else do we know about how synaptic transmission is modified by serotonin? Well, another way that we've studied it is to look at the recycling of synaptic vesicles, which are here labeled with a dye called FM143. So FM143 is a dye that partitions into membranes. So you soak a cell in FM143 and the membrane lights up, it's fluorescent, and then you wash it out and it washes out. So what you can do is you can soak the cell in this dye and then you can stimulate for a while and then you can wash it out. So now it disappears from the surface membrane and you have these little dots scattered along the nerve terminals. Basically each dot, which is called a puncto, which simply, whenever you use Latin, it means you don't know what it means, so you use Latin. It's a dot. Each dot is probably a bouton and a cluster of active zones, maybe 20 or 30 active zones. And the reason these boutons become fluorescent is that when you have exocytosis followed by endocytosis during stimulation, then you're trapping external membrane and sucking it into the cell, and the dye is still there. Now when you wash the dye out of the external membrane, you can't wash it out of the endocytosed vesicles. It's trapped in there. So that's the only thing that remains fluorescent. Well, if you stimulate again with the absence of dye, you get destaining. It disappears. And that's because the vesicles become reused. And when there's a whole field that studies, you know, the time course of reavailability of vesicles, or do they become reused immediately? No, it takes about 30 seconds to a minute and things like that. In other words, they go through some kind of refilling stage and they have to find docking sites. And there's a lot that is uses this technique to follow vesicles through their life cycle. So, what here we're just showing increasing the frequency, of course, increases the rate of destaining, while this is what happens without any stimulation at a much faster rate of taking pictures. That's photo bleach. So there's this is much faster than photo bleach, and we don't take nearly as many pictures here as here, so don't worry about photo bleach. So we can use this method to measure the properties of a pool of vesicles. And basically, what you have is a pool of vesicles that are partially labeled that are released at a certain frequency. And the rate at which that pool is depleted is going to be proportional to the frequency of stimulation, little f, and then the fraction of the pool that each spike releases times big F times the pool size of the pool. So it's a fraction of the pool. So this is the simplest possible model of what happens to a single pool of vesicles, leading to an exponential decline in the pool size. And you have another measure, which is the EPSP amplitude, which is equal to the number of quanta released, that's the pool size times the fraction of the pool released, times the quanta amplitude. And plugging in the time constant from the decay of destaining into this, you can quickly deduce the size of the pool. So it's easy that from the time constant, you can deduce the fraction of the pool released per spike. All you need to know is the frequency. And knowing the amplitude of the PSP and quanta, you can deduce the size of the pool. So using this very simple model, the simplest possible kind of depletion model of destaining, we can ask what happens in the presence of serotonin. So here are two tetani. We stimulate once. In the presence of the dye, we wash out the dye and destain. And then we stimulate again in the presence of the dye, and then we wash out the dye and destain. We do it twice, and we get a repeatable destaining. Now, the second time, serotonin's present throughout the experiment. So first of all, the staining is higher. It's twice as much staining, which is funny, because if you totally labeled the pool, it's as if the pool got twice as big. And second, the time constant is the same, which I'll show you the... You can't quite see that, but I mean, it may look like it's about right, but it is. So the time constant is the fraction of the pool released, and that didn't change. Therefore, the pool got bigger. Two indications the pool got bigger. More staining, and it doesn't. The unloading rate is not faster. So meanwhile, the PSPs, they grow during the tetanus due to facilitation, augmentation, and potentiation, while, of course, in serotonin, they grow to twice as big. and here we have twice as much staining. So another way to study pools, a very common way, is to look at depression. Now the nice thing about the crayfish is it usually doesn't show any depression, but if you stimulate long enough and hard enough, you get facilitation, augmentation, and potentiation, and then a gradual decline in the PSPs as you gradually deplete the total pool. And you can fit a very simple model of a total vesicle pool consisting of the initial resting pool minus what's been released previously is what's left. And you can suppose that the rate at which that pool is depleted is equal to a release rate times its present size, and then it's replenished with a recovery rate times what is available for recovery. So basically, this is release, which is due to stimulation. This is recovery, which is due to endocytosis. You have a cycling through this pool. This is, again, a very simple model that leads to an exponential decay in the size of the pool. But you not only what you can measure is the EPSP amplitude, which is the quantal size times the fraction of the pool released times the size of the pool. That also declines exponentially. And by looking at the initial size of the EPSP at rest and the final size of the EPSP at steady state, when you've been stimulating for a long time, you can combine these two and get an estimate of the initial pool size. It's very straightforward algebra. So when we do that, I mean, basically what we see here is that the EPSP gets bigger, but at very high frequency stimulation for a very long time, it declines at about the same time constant. And by measuring the time constant, the initial size, and the final size, plugging them into those simple equations, you can estimate the size of the pool. And here are what we get. By the destaining method, the pool doubles over what it would have otherwise been in the second tetanus. The fraction of the pool released, there's no significant change or a slight increase. By the depression method, the pool size, here, is not quite double, but about 70%, 60% bigger than it would have otherwise been in the second tetanus. So there's a significant increase in the pool size and no significant increase in the fraction of the pool released, exactly the opposite of what everybody, including me, expected. And also the maximum staining is, this is the percent increase, which is about double.
Double a releasable pool?
Well, it's not an immediately releasable pool. The size of this pool is a million vesicles. We are certainly talking about the total pool of vesicles. We don't change the fraction released. Not, yeah, the amount certainly gets released because that's a bigger PSP. But that's right. So now the question is, what does it mean to increase the pool size? Oh, well, one more indication. We can increase the pool size in serotonin and then wash out the serotonin and then look at what happens to destaining. So that means we would decrease the pool size, right? Let's stain in the presence of serotonin when there's a big pool, wash out the serotonin. Now there should be a small pool, right? Well, what happens to the stain? Well, when you do that, you only lose half of it. The other half is trapped. So now this says that increasing the size of the pool could be one of two things that I can think of. We either recruit a reserve pool that isn't normally active, and then when we take away the serotonin, we make it inactive so that dye is trapped there. Or we could activate release sites that don't normally transmit. If they don't transmit, their vesicles don't stain and they don't destain. They just sit there, but they're not part of the pool. And I've spent a lot of time trying to distinguish those two, and I can show you a lot of negative results that don't mean anything, so I'm going to skip that. I don't know which of those is true. We don't have the resolution to measure individual active zones. We can only measure puncta, Latin for dot. And puncta are about 40 active zones. So if half the active zones become active, you get a brighter puncta. You don't get more punctum. Punctae. If we had the resolution to look at single active zones, it would be maybe I could resolve the question. So the IH channel or the HCN channel is activated by cyclic AMP, which is turned on by a cyclase. and that involving the actin cytoskeleton in some way increases the size of the pool that's available for release. So that was the first, actually, half. It's supposed to take 45 minutes. So we started at 10, and we should. Why don't we take a 10-minute break and come back, and then I'll talk for another 45 minutes.
All right. So can I ask you, is it clear that they're discrete entities?
Well, yeah, they're defined as clusters of vesicles opposed to a thick presynaptic membrane that actually has actin filaments in it. And that are sitting immediately opposite a postsynaptic density of receptors, which can be labeled. So that's the structural definition of an active zone. It's real. And you can also show that transmitter release occurs there by many methods. And
it's fine, but it does not speak to that modularity. I mean, it could be that you have a diffuse web of these structures. You speak of like the active zones.
Right.
It's clear that there are positive dots.
Well, it is clear. In the EM, there are actually between 20 and 40 active zones per bouton, but they're defined ultrastructurally. Now, my dots are too big because those active zones are a half micron apart, which is less than the wavelength of light. So anyone who says he can resolve that is a liar using light microscopy. And you get a blur that is several microns wide, and those are active zones around a sphere of several microns, and that's 20 or...
there is evidence for strict modularity.
Yeah. But whether I'm turning active zones on or off, or just making each one of them transmit more effectively because it has a higher probability of release, because the pool available to them is greater, I can't distinguish that.
What happens, and I'm not sure if you have the answer, but you can probably tell us if you've had it, but what happens between the HCN and actin? What could bridge it?
So that's sort of, I'm going to speculate at the end of the talk, but I think actin acts as a glue. The original idea was that actin acted as a string tugging on things, which is a lovely idea, but totally silly. I think almost certainly completely wrong.
Some think that those are some kind of tracks that the vesicles would have to follow.
Well, that's what tubulin provides, and I use nicotizol and it doesn't do a thing. So, I mean, that's why I tried nicotizol. And the vesicles line up along microtubules in the axon. They do not line up along microfilaments in the terminal. So they don't look like tracks. Well, myosin filaments, tubulin tubes look like tracks. A lot of biology is based on look-like as opposed to what it really necessarily is. My original idea was that the IH channels were originally only in the axon because that's where the calcium can be detected. And then how in the world can they affect the boutons? Well, if you draw a line from the axon to the bouton and ask a student what it is, they'll open a textbook on the synapse and say, it says here, tubulin. See the line? Just where you drew it. So that's why I tried nicotizol. And then the student will say, well, maybe it's an actin line. Yeah, well, I think that's ridiculous. I think the actin acts as a glue.
Yeah, no matter how the actin acts, how does the ACN channel, how does it interact?
Well, I have no idea. So it looks like it's kind of some sort of direct interaction that doesn't involve calcium or depolarization or anything else. So that's a question that should be answered.
Do you expect the IH is going to be near the active zone?
I would think it's really in the active zone. So, and of course, that's why I tried this antibody, which is fluorescently labeled. But it doesn't bind to anything in crayfish. And so somebody would have to clone the HCN channel from crayfish and then make an antibody to that, which is not something I can do in a couple weeks. So, in fact, I'm not going to do it at all. I'm going to leave it to biochemists if I can turn anybody on to this stuff. I will certainly turn people on to it when you... at the end of the second part of the talk, I will tell you why everybody's going to care about this stuff.
Right.
But I'm going to get a cup of coffee and then we can start. The second part has nothing to do with serotonin or cyclic AMP. People often ask, by the way, what serotonin receptor is this? And the answer is, I don't know. We spent a couple of months looking at mixtures of antagonists and agonists and got totally contradictory results, which probably means that a crayfish is not a rat and that it doesn't have serotonin receptors that are pharmacologically identical to any of those in mammals. And so I won't tell you about all the results and all the inconsistencies. We don't know what kind of receptor. So this is another process called long-term facilitation, so named so as not to confuse it necessarily with LTP, and named actually by the person who first described it, which is Harold Atwood at the University of Toronto. So the way this long-term facilitation is induced is to stimulate the motor neuron at moderately high frequency, 20 hertz. You can push it to 50 or 60 or 70 hertz, so this is not, that's what you have to do to get depression. But at only 20 hertz for about 10 minutes, of course, during the tetanus, transmission goes way up. Here it's about 35-fold what it starts at. And that's facilitation, augmentation, and potentiation with pretty much no sign of depression. There's depression starting to come in here, just barely. And if we would prolong this, you know, it would eventually go down. But then we stop the tetanus and measure PSPs once every couple seconds afterwards. And of course, facilitation decays rapidly, so does augmentation. This is PTP here. It lasts for several minutes. But then you see there's something that just won't go away. And it lasts for hours, and in fact, days. So it's certainly long-term. The reason it isn't called LTP is if you give a brief burst of action potentials at, say, 100 hertz for a couple of seconds, and repeat it three times, you don't get this. And that's what you use to get LTP. And so since it's induced differently, it was given a different name so as not to presume that anything we understand about this necessarily applies to mammals. We just don't presume that and give it a different name. Same prep, exactly the same prep. It can be seen as a natural phenomenon, so it turns out that you can record extracellularly, intramuscularly from animals that are aroused, basically threatened. And they go up and they open their claws like this. That's the claw opener. And they'll do that for minutes. And sure, you actually get this kind of high-frequency stimulation for that long. And then afterwards, there is LTF in an intact, normal animal. So it's not just an artifact of the field of neurophysiology, although that wouldn't stop us. It's measured as this fairly persistent, nearly flat increase in transmission. And here you can see it's about 250%. Percent of control, that's double. That would be triple. It's about 2.5. Frequently, it's a 200% change. The PSP is twice as big as it was, 100% increase, which is very similar to what has most neurophysiologists extremely excited about the cortex. Same kind of magnitude and synaptic change. Not big, but big enough to matter. So This has absolutely nothing to do with PKA. Three different PKA inhibitors. Here's the one I can never remember, KT5720, H7RP, bromocyclic AMPS. Have no effect on any phase of synaptic plasticity or baseline transmission at all. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Okay. It also isn't affected by CAM kinase inhibitors, here are two of them, or by a PKC inhibitor, MIR-PKCI. H7 is also a PKC inhibitor. The standard kinases have nothing to do with this. And it probably doesn't involve cyclic AMP at all. For instance, you can't occlude it by giving a big Forskolin stimulus. It certainly doesn't have anything to do with cyclic AMP dependent kinase, but it probably doesn't have anything to do with cyclic AMP at all. It's not enhanced by IBMX. It doesn't show any of the signs of something that's cyclic AMP dependent. So it's also not accompanied by any change in membrane potential. Here's the resting membrane potential during a tetanus, but in the LTF period afterwards, there's no change in membrane potential, there's no change in the amplitude of the spike, there's no change in the half-width of the spike. Now, in the PTP period, during and at the end of a tetanus, there is, for instance, during a tetanus, there's a clear hyperpolarization.
Ah, a clue.
And also the action potential amplitude and duration change, but afterwards they come right back. So at least during the period that this is expressed, there's nothing electrical going on that we can detect in the resting or action potentials. But clearly this hyperpolarization is suggestive of something that could be involved. So, well, what does happen during a tetanus? Well, the calcium goes up and down, and that is relevant, but something else happens. Calcium, it could be that that hyperpolarization comes from calcium, but it doesn't because you can get it in inhibitors. I don't have a slide showing that, but you still get it when you inhibit calcium channels with omega conotoxin. So it's not, or calcium activated potassium channels with TEA. So that's not where that hyperpolarization comes from, and I didn't bring those negative results. Here's where it does come from. This looks like a Fuhrer image. So those who are used to Fuhrer images know that what you do is you measure, you excite with two different wavelengths this dye, and you measure the fluorescence, and you take the ratio of that fluorescence, and you convert that to a color. And here's the color bar here. These are the different colors, and then you calibrate the dye, and you change and you convert colors to concentrations. But this is not Fura. This is SBFI. And SBFI does not measure calcium. It measures sodium. And it has an affinity in the millimolar range, tens of millimolar, so it measures changes in presynaptic sodium in exactly the range it should start at, a few millimolar or 10 millimolar or so. And actually, there's a rather substantial rise in sodium concentration at the end of a tetanus, which recovers after the tetanus. And here, these pictures were taken at this point, and this point. And these two lines were measured from here, one bouton, or from here, a preterminal axon. And in both cases, the sodium goes way up, from 10 to about 60 or 70 millimoles. External sodium is about 200, so we haven't reversed the sodium gradient. It's still coming in, but we've cut it down by a third. So the action potentials get smaller, which was shown on a previous slide, during the tetanus. So there's a big sodium load, and it is pumped out. See, there it goes. Now you see it, now you don't. And the way sodium is pumped out is by a sodium-potassium exchange, which is electrogenic and causes a hyperpolarization. And there's the hyperpolarization during and after the tetanus, recovering after the tetanus, and it's blocked by wobane.
What?
Wobane is a drug which blocks the sodium-potassium exchange. So when you block the sodium-potassium exchange, which has to be what removes sodium, nothing else will, and which is electrogenic, and which has to hyperpolarize, you block the hyperpolarization that you see, all of which was actually known 20 years ago. So that hyperpolarization is caused by sodium-potassium pump, and then you get a depolarization because you reduce the sodium gradient, and you, that contributes to the resting potential.
Sorry, can you resolve how much the sodium concentration changes per spike?
I could, but I haven't tried to. I could sit here and measure this slope and do it right now, but why don't we do it later? Because I'd have to get out a ruler and measure it. I haven't actually done that. Why? I mean, it's not much. I mean, this is thousands of spikes divided by, you know, I mean, let's say 1,000 spikes, and if you want an order of magnitude, divide 50 millimoles by 1,000 spikes, because you can see it's the rising phases. It's not, by this point it reaches a steady state. So that would be 50 micromoles, but that's probably an order of magnitude guess. So these are small boutons and small processes. I mean, 50 micromoles is actually a lot, but there's no sodium buffer like there is a calcium buffer. So what comes in is free. So it still seems like a lot, but anyway, that's only order of magnitude. So that's, you know, plus or minus a factor of 10, one log unit. Okay, that hyperpolarization is enhanced by an IH channel blocker. Now that's what you'd expect if it turns on IH channels. If a hyperpolarization activates IH channels, it activates a non-specific cation channel, which causes a depolarization and counteracts the thing that's activating it. So that means if you block the IH channel, the hyperpolarization, which comes from the pump, should be even bigger, and it is. So that means that the hyperpolarization that you normally see is due to the potassium-sodium exchange hyperpolarizing the membrane and opening a channel which counteracts it. And when you remove the counteracting effect, you get a bigger hyperpolarization. So that means the hyperpolarization is sufficient to activate IH channels. And you might expect that that would cause an effect on transmitter release. And sure enough, LTF is almost completely blocked by IH channel blockers. So this is a kind of synaptic plasticity, not neuromodulation, but a homosynaptic plasticity, which in some ways resembles LTP, which is mediated by the activation of this presynaptic ion channel. In this case, activated by hyperpolarization, not by cyclic AMP. So, here's another one. So, not only ZD7288 does block the induction of LTF, but DKAH269, which is the other IH channel blocker. This is just a PSP before and after the tetanus, and this is before and after the tetanus in the presence of a blocker. So in this case, we really completely knocked it out. Likewise here, we've completely knocked it out in these experiments, a different set of experiments.
So this IH channel is the same HCN channel you were talking
about? Yeah, right. So, and the three actin depolymerizers reduce, although they don't completely eliminate, the induction of long-term facilitation. Just like they reduce but do not completely eliminate the effect of forskolin. All three of them. So, There's a kind of an axiom in biology. If it's long-term, it involves protein synthesis. Ever since Axelrod and his goldfish, that's been true. Anything that lasts for days has to involve protein synthesis. There's nothing else you can do that lasts that long. So it was obvious that long-term facilitation involved protein synthesis, and that protein synthesis inhibitors would block its induction. It was so obvious that some people didn't even think it was necessary to do an experiment. But anyhow, it's true, as well as being obvious. On the other hand, transcription inhibitors, DRB, which I never can remember, is dichlororibofuranosyl benzimidazole. also called DRB. In fact, only ever called DRB. I don't know anybody else who could even tell me what that is, of all the people who use it. Anyhow, that blocks transcription of DNA into RNA, and it has no effect. Now, that's not too surprising because the nucleus is in the icebox. We work with the isolated claw, and the ganglion where the motor neuron nucleus is was never around throughout the experiment. Although it is possible that there was a postsynaptic transcription in the muscle. It was possible, but it's not true. Well, where does the protein synthesis occur then? Not in the motor neuron nucleus, because that's in the icebox. And not in the muscle, maybe? It's possible. Maybe there's a retrograde message. Anything's possible these days. So what we use is an RNA capping protein, which can be injected presynaptically or postsynaptically, and this blocks the translation of proteins at ribosomes. And when it was injected presynaptically, we blocked the induction of long-term facilitation, while when it was injected postsynaptically into the same cell that we were recording from, we have no effect. So it is presynaptic local protein synthesis that regulates this form of synaptic plasticity in us. That's actually the first time that's been shown. And maybe it just isn't true anywhere else, but I doubt it. Just to remind you that...
So what's the dogma? Maybe you tell us the sort of standard view is that...
It happens in the cell body, but near the nucleus, and appearing
In dendrites.
Yeah, there's actually now evidence of local protein synthesis being important in dendrites for regulation of synaptic transmission.
Evidence for RNA transfer to
Yeah, so people know the RNA is there, and they know the ribosomes are there. No, it's only been known that the machinery is there, and so for the people who know that, this is not at all surprising. They said, "Ah, I predicted that. You didn't even need to do the experiment." So, just to remind you that the Forskalin response is not affected at all by protein synthesis inhibitors. Remember the Forskalin response, take away the Forskalin, it recovers within minutes, while this is some long-term effect. So they're not exactly the same. They both involve IH activation or HCN activation, but one of them is a persistent effect and the other is a transient effect. And we'll get to more reasons for the difference in a minute. Actually, in a second. Here it is. So what's the difference between a tetanus and Forskalin? Well, Forskalin causes the calcium to rise a tiny little bit, right, through leaking in through IH channels in the pre-terminal axons. While a tetanus, you have lots of calcium coming in. Whoosh. So we can give a tetanus in a calcium-free medium, either with calcium substituted with manganese or with a small amount of EGTA. And of course, that blocks synaptic transmission. And here it doesn't block it completely, probably because we have no chelator here. So there's really some calcium present. We haven't chelated it. While here, there's probably no calcium present. There's almost no transmission there. And then we can wash this. We give the tetanus, okay, nothing happens. And then we can wash out the tetanus, wash out the calcium-free solution, go back to normal medium, and ask, did that tetanus induce an LTF? Here's where we started before we added the calcium-free medium. And the answer is no. So apparently, calcium has to come in during a tetanus in order to get long-term facilitation.
When does something like tetanus happen in this system?
Well, when the animal's aroused. So that's been recorded in naturally moving animals. I mentioned that a while in the beginning of the LTF part. This really happens in real crayfish. The average frequency reaches 20 hertz. Of course, it's random. It's not uniform, not regular. But
so if you give what you record when the animal is sighted?
No one's done that. No one's tried to record that train and then feed it back. Yeah. Red curve is zero calcium. Black curve is control. So control means you just give the tetanus. You always give a tetanus. But I guess I should have made this, I should have made this red too. Yeah. Yeah. So a calcium influx is required for this long-term effect. Now you can say, you still activated the IH channels. Didn't you get a short-term effect? Well, you know, it takes a while to wash the calcium back in, so you can't tell what happens in the short term. So, I don't know. Another thing is that this has been known for quite a while, that during the long-term facilitation period, there is no elevation in resting calcium. So there is during facilitation, there is during augmentation, there is during potentiation, but not during LTF. There's no change in, so it's not some effect of residual calcium, because there is no detectable residual calcium anywhere. Not in axons, not in boutons, anywhere. So calcium is involved in the induction, but not the expression. It's needed to cause it, but not to maintain it. So where does calcium act? I mentioned it doesn't work on CAM kinase. Everybody knows that's what calcium always does in synaptic plasticity. Not here. So the next most commonly thought of enzyme that is a calcium target is calcineurin. This is a calcium-dependent phosphatase instead of a kinase. It dephosphorylates proteins instead of phosphorylating them. And finally, I told you all these things that have no effect. Finally, an effect. Cyclosporin A, ascomycin, and CAM kinase autoinhibitory peptide, which has to be presynaptically injected, all reduce LTF. This is the amount of LTF. So 100% is a doubling. This is basically no significant change, no significant change, no significant change. This is a mock injection of the vehicle. So our injection does not cause damage. So perhaps calcium is acting on a phosphatase instead of a kinase. What about other kinases? Now it's phosphatases. So now we're slowly slipping down the hole into biochemistry here. And I'm going to go all the way to the bottom. So these are inhibitors of other phosphatases, which are calcium independent. Phosphatase 1 and 2A are protein phosphatases that are not activated by calcium. And instead of blocking LTF, we got a massive enhancement of LTF, although no effect on the baseline transmission. So it's not a phosphatase cascade. In fact, different dephosphorylating different enzymes has different effects. If you prevent one dephosphorylation, you get LTF. If you prevent this dephosphorylation, you get much more LTF. It's not simple. So, I'll tell you in a minute where we got these ideas, but we started looking at some other kinases that are not so commonly used in biology, but are getting more common. One is MAP kinases, which these are involved, among other things, in the control of protein or RNA translation and protein synthesis. That's why we got interested in them. And a specific inhibitor of P38 MAP kinase has no effect, but a specific inhibitor of P40, which is P40 and 42 MAP kinases, blocks LTF induction. A specific inhibitor of phosphoinositide 3 kinase blocks LTF induction. A specific inhibitor of what's called rapamycin, which blocks mTOR. What's that? Why, that's the target of rapamycin. That's what TOR means. Which is okay, so that's real useful. But anyhow, it's also called FRAP, and I can tell you what that is too. Anyhow, another specific kinase inhibitor blocks the induction of LTF, and these two guys both work on PI3 kinase. And I'm going to stop showing you traces because you get the idea, either it's blocked or it isn't. This is a summary of the kinds of biochemical experiments we've done. Inhibitors of PKA, PKC, CAM kinase, even PKG, two of these inhibit PKG, P38 MAP kinase, and tyrosine protein kinase, all are without effect. These are the most common inhibitors used in other signaling pathways in neurobiology and modulation of ion channels and modulation of receptors. Instead, what was effective were inhibitors of PI3 kinase, phosphoinositide 3 kinase, MAP kinase kinase, which is this guy, mTOR, the target of rapamycin, and calcineurin. While an inhibitor of another class of protein phosphates enhanced transmission a lot. Enhanced, not transmission, but LTF. None of these had any effect on baseline transmission at all. Or on facilitation, potentiation, PTP, augmentation, any of that. So where did I get the idea to try all of these things? I mean, did I just go through some biochemistry book and just look under enzyme and pick all the inhibitors? No, almost, but not quite. They all are known to be involved in pathways that regulate protein synthesis. So protein synthesis can be activated by a eukaryotic initiation factor. Actually, this is inhibits it. So, this activates it. Activates, plus. That, there is a binding protein which blocks that. And that binding protein is affected by mTOR and by PI3 kinase through this kinase cascade. So basically, this kinase cascade phosphorylates, this is known, this is not hypothetical, phosphorylates this eukaryotic initiation factor 4 binding protein and removes it from inhibition. So that means they activate protein synthesis. You remove an inhibitor. And when I block it, then I block the removal of an inhibition, and I block protein synthesis. That's what made me try these drugs, because I thought that might be how they work. I don't really know if that's what's going on here. This could all be just coincidence. Another kinase, S6, also activates protein kinase, and it's also activated by PI3 kinase and by rapamycin, by a kinase that's inhibited by rapamycin. So I don't really know if it's this pathway that I'm inhibiting or this pathway that I'm inhibiting. And this is another pathway that's known, a series of kinases, to activate EIF4 and activate protein synthesis. And that's where I got the idea to try this inhibitor, which is a MAP kinase kinase. This inhibitor, on the other hand, had no effect. So I think that it's not coincidence that all of the kinases that affect or are involved in long-term facilitation are involved in the regulation of protein synthesis, which is required for LTF expression. I think that's not a coincidence, but I don't really know. Where does calcineurin work? Okay, now you see the question marks? The question marks mean that they're in my imagination. I made them up. That's what it means. Should be big question mark, probably. Big, bold question mark. I could imagine that this protein has to be phosphorylated, and the dephosphorylating it inactivates it. So when I block that dephos... let's see, is that right? Right. The calcineurin has to be active to dephosphorylate it. And when I block calcineurin, I block that essential dephosphorylation. It's just an idea. This could be the effect of PP21 and 2A. It's known that you have to dephosphorylate this factor to remove inhibition. So it could be that normally this phosphatase is phosphorylated. And that it's possible that normally this phosphatase is keeping it dephosphorylated, and so it's partly active all the time and partly inhibiting all the time. And so when I block this, inhibition, it goes in that state. I removed an inhibitor. It's just possible. Question mark means I'm guessing. And this could be the target of calcium action. Why? Because I don't see any other targets here. I'm guessing. But if all of this is not what's going on, then I don't know what is. So last part is a kind of metaplasticity that I want to talk about. That is a rather strange kind of dependence on prior activity in the ability to regulate long-term facilitation. The first clue of it came here that here's force gland, turn it on, add force gland, you get a response, it gets bigger, take it away, it recovers. And that effect's blocked by an IH inhibitor, two different IH inhibitors, DKAH269 and ZD7288. What happens if I add force gland for a long time? Well, you see the response persists for as long as it's there. What happens if I add an IH inhibitor at this point? Doesn't matter. So this is a little puzzling because it says force gland is continuing to have some action, but the continued action is IH independent. In other words, once you've activated the IH channel, force gland continues to work by some other means to maintain the response. There's both an initiation, which is IH dependent, and a maintenance, which is not. And all of this can be done in the presence of PKA inhibitors, because some people just don't believe that it could be PKA independent, so we throw this in every time a reviewer tells us to, just to shut them up. So this is two different inhibitors. These two inhibitors, when present throughout the experiment, block the response, but when added at the after, while force gland has been there for a while, they don't block the response until the force gland is removed. IH. These are IH inhibitors. So you can see maintenance is IH independent. Initiation is IH dependent. Now, an even stranger result, and this is it's getting stranger and stranger. Here we've induced long-term facilitation. We haven't induced. So I should have shown in it. Now, I left out a slide. I was trying to cut the number of slides down. If we don't have any multiple protein synthesis inhibitors here, we induce LTH here. And following that, we get a force gland response. Good. You can get both. They don't occlude each other. Now, here, it turns out that force gland response occurs in the presence of an IH inhibitor. Normally, this would block it. So a prior activation of IH renders a subsequent response to force gland IH independent. It's like a maintenance rather than an initiation. So you can then ask, well, what happens here that does that? Maybe it was protein synthesis. No, because we've inhibited protein synthesis all the way through. Or maybe it was PI3 active. No. Or maybe it was that MAP kinase. No. And maybe it was calcineurin. No, we've inhibited all of them. That's why there's no LTF here. So there's no LTF because we used every possible one. And yet it still has this effect that a subsequent exposure to force gland is now IH independent.
So if you wait long enough, does that effect go away?
Yeah, we haven't done that yet. And so, eventually it must, but I have no idea what its duration is, and that's a really important question. So we call this temporal tagging. It's a way of temporally marking the synapse so that afterwards it doesn't require IH activation to induce a force gland or serotonin response.
Normally, when you block IH here, but I want to get a feeling if IH is always present in the normal condition.
Well, IH is normally, I probably should have worked into this slowly, step by step.
Yeah.
The first experiment is you get a tetanus and you get LTF and you get force gland, you get a response. Now, normally, ZD blocks the force gland response.
No, I understand the logical reason.
Yeah,
asking if you don't put any blocker, just under normal
conditions. Yeah, so under normal conditions...
IH is always...
Well, if you under normal conditions, you get LTF and then you get a force gland response, and IH will be activated both times.
So this is partly fine, but
in what you're saying.
I left out a whole bunch of slides that sort of led up to this one slide. I have a table that I'm going to get to that shows all of those, but
the dependence of IH. The dependent there
an IH, I don't think it's that puzzling, because IH itself is only active a short amount of time after the...
Well, right,
more,
and...
I think more puzzling is that it's independent of these proteins that's into this thing, then it's bridged over an hour.
Right, well, yeah, this is, yeah.
No, the proteins were synthesized.
Well,
see, there, we blocked, so we don't actually have LTF induction here, because we blocked LTF induction with all of these things, and still we have this effect. So it's not LTF is not required to do this.
What kind of memory you have for the long time?
On the other, and another way to look at this is, if you, so again, an experiment that I left out is if ZD is present all the way through the experiment, all the way, then you don't get LTF, and you also don't get a response to Forskalin, because you never activated IH. Okay, you never set the tag. So the IH channel has to be activated, apparently, to set the tag. But the tag is not dependent on any of these kinases or protein synthesis.
So this is, in that respect, very different than a Frey Norris kind of tag, like,
yeah,
protein synthesis.
Well, and that's a spatial tag. It's really, I don't know if someone can come up with a better word. Every time I come up with a word, someone argues. Mark, no, someone used that. Prime, no, you can't use prime. Imprint, no. And so I'm just going to call it a tag. But I call it a temporal tag, always temporal, because it's not like their spatial tag at all.
So way early on, you said about half of the effect was...
of serotonin.
Yeah.
So I don't use serotonin anymore. I'm only using this part.
Forceful, so we're not, I mean, can that be... So the answer's going on.
Yeah, so that means cyclic AMP is having a second effect that is not simply activating IH channels, which is also what was implied by this result. That is, if you block IH channels at this point on, Forskalin is continuing to have some other effect. So they both suggest a second target, which is not PKA. No, not PKA. PKA is knocked out all the way through the experiment. Some other target of cyclic AMP. So you can also do this with actin depolymerizers. If they're present throughout the whole experiment, you don't get LTF, and the Forskalin response is really small. This is a 30% increase, really small. Normally you get about a 100% increase. On the other hand, if you induce LTF first, now the Forskalin response is way back, I've noticed the change in scale here. It's way back up to 300%. Nice big response, but it's independent of actin inhibitors. So basically, pre-activating IH, whether or not you get LTF, because you can block LTF with all these other inhibitors, but pre-activating IH renders the synapses independent of IH inhibition, or resistant to IH inhibition and resistant to actin depolymerization. The thing that actin and IH do has already happened. So it doesn't work in the other direction. Here's Forskalin first, and here's a tetanus, and here's LTF. So there's the Forskalin response, and here's a tetanus, and there's LTF. So they're both responses. But now the LTF is blocked by an IH inhibitor. And it's also blocked, I don't think I have it in here, by an actin depolymerizer. So that's interesting. In this direction, whatever happened, at least it doesn't persist very long. So what's so interesting about a tetanus that's different from, oh, here it is, that's the lentrunculin effect. So now lentrunculin blocked the long-term facilitation, just the way it normally does, even though we initially had a Forskalin response. While all by its, well, right. This is what happens without lentrunculin, and this is what happens with lentrunculin. It really does block it. So that's just two different experiments. So this tagging after a tetanus that makes it IH independent and actin independent doesn't occur after Forskalin. Well, what's so special about a tetanus? Well, I don't know what happened to this slide. It's got a lot of schmutz on it. But anyway, you have calcium coming in. So in a calcium-free medium, we know that tetanus doesn't give LTF. And it doesn't cause a tag either. Because now the fluorescein response is blocked by an IH inhibitor, and it's also blocked by an actin depolymerizer. So a tetanus tags the synapse so that it can now be activated by fluorescein without IH and without actin involvement. And that tag is calcium dependent. So this is a summary of the logic of those experiments. One means you get a more than a 100% or more increase in synaptic transmission, and zero means you get a 30% or less. So they're really non-overlapping and statistically significant. So fluorescein gives an increase in synaptic transmission, which is blocked by IH inhibitors and actin inhibitors. And a tetanus gives an increase in synaptic transmission, which is blocked by IH inhibitors and actin inhibitors. If you block IH inhibitors throughout the experiment, then you don't get a response either to the tetanus or to fluorescein. If you block actin, or if you cause depolymerization of actin throughout the experiment, you don't get a response to long-term facilitation or fluorescein. And that's also true in the other direction, I think. You know, actually, we haven't done that yet. So some of these numbers were filled in the last few days. On the other hand, if you generate LTF initially, and then so you get a response to LTF, and follow it by fluorescein, you get a response even in the presence of an IH inhibitor, even in the presence of an actin inhibitor, and that so you rendered it independent of IH or actin depolymerization. And that occurs even though there only these inhibitors are present. Calcineurin, MAP kinase, PA3 kinase, mTOR, and protein synthesis, all those inhibitors present. Then, of course, when those inhibitors are present, you don't get LTF, but you still get this tagging. You still get a response to fluorescein now in the presence of an IH inhibitor. The tagging is unidirectional. If you start with fluorescein and then follow it with LTF, the LTF induction is still blocked by IH and is still blocked by actin inhibitors. And calcium is required for the tagging. A tetanus in a calcium-free medium, now fluorescein is still blocked by IH inhibitors and still blocked by actin inhibitors. So all of these experiments were done at least four times by yesterday. The ones that haven't been repeated four times, I'm not going to talk about yet. So this is a kind of complex metaplasticity and a complex history dependence of what controls these synapses that we never anticipated. So this summarizes all the other stuff that I said, except the tagging part, which this slide's complicated enough already. We have synaptic enhancement, which is due to an increased pool size measured by FM143 destaining and depletion experiments, which is activated by 5-HT working in part through cyclic AMP to activate IH channels. And here I put the cyclic nucleotide arm of activation IH channels, which may mobilize vesicles. And there may be, I prefer the actin glue hypothesis as opposed to the actin tracks hypothesis of what role actin is playing here. So that it's probably holding IH channels in association with some secretory protein. In addition, you can activate those channels by hyperpolarization in a tetanus. So blocking IH channels prevents that. Again, depletion experiments suggest an increased pool size, and Atwood and colleagues have done electron microscopy and have found what look like additional functional active zones, where a functional active zone is defined as one with a dense body in it. Well, if you build a dense body, of course you need protein synthesis. And it is indeed protein synthesis dependent, and it's dependent on a number of kinases which are known to activate protein synthetic pathways. It's also dependent on the activity of one particular phosphatase, calcium-dependent phosphatase, while on the other hand, if you block this phosphatase, you get even more LTF instead of less. So this must be normally inhibiting it. And I think that's what this says. So this is sort of a summary of these two types of regulation of synaptic transmission by these channels that were really, to me, quite astonishing. And of course, you notice my name's not on here. I don't do any of the experiments. I travel around the world and talk, like most of us, I guess. The initial calcium measurements involved in serotonin's action were done by Kerry Delaney, who's at Simon Fraser University, and by Yung-Yi Tang, who's at Sutter Instruments. And the studies on FM143 and depletion were done by Chang Wang, who's at Axon. And some of the effects of inhibitors on LTF were done by two graduate students who were actually just rotating through the lab, dumping on chemicals the way they were told, Robert Frumke and Russell Fletcher, but we didn't trust any of it, although they were absolutely right, and repeated everything they did, and we means Vari Beaumont, and she's the star of this. She just moved, and I didn't make a new slide. She's now at the University of Cambridge, and is the real star of this work. She's done about two-thirds of the experiments that I described. And Russell English keeps everything in the lab working. So that's it.
In the temporal tagging.
Guess we're going to see this whether we like it or not.
In the temporal tagging case, where you had the protein synthesis inhibitors on there. So the protein synthesis prevented the LTF from happening.
Right.
But then when you put on when you induce it later on, again, does it come down? I don't remember. So, like...
You can't go backward either. We are absolutely stuck with this slide. These people really want recognition. Okay, well... yeah, pushed... Oh, well, now we got several slides. No matter what, we're going to see that slide. Keep going. Let's just pile them up to see if they'll all maybe melt. Yeah, that did it. Okay.
Take the lid off and take the slide out of
here.
If you rotate that, the slides would just all fall out onto the ground. So be careful. Yeah. Actually. Yeah, we don't need them yet. That should do it. Now.
Okay, exactly.
Yeah.
So it seems that, if I'm reading this right, that even in the present, in the second induction, I mean, here you have a second, it's, I don't know if it's staying up, but it seems to go up and for at least a certain amount of time stay up.
Oh, no. You mean this here?
Yeah.
Oh, well, this is the normal time course of a Forskalin response. It lasts about another 20 minutes and, you know, has a time constant of 10 to 20 minutes and is gone pretty much
and
after
then
40.
The tail of that.
Yeah, I...
We presume it would go down back to baseline because there's no protein control.
Well, here is baseline, so it has gone down. And I don't think this is slower or faster than normal. And this is sort of the normal decay of a Forskalin response. It looks about like this.
Yeah, but LTF...
Well, LTF, LTF stays up. It's really flat for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And,
I mean,
and
I,
yeah.
I remember this as being flat, and I guess I
so LTF would be...
I understand how this could, the second one could be flat in the absence of protein sensory inhibitor, but it's not. Okay.
Right, so an example of that one is here. There's LTF. There it is.
Yeah.
Normal, no protein synthesis or any of those other inhibitors, so you get normal LTF. But, and then you get a normal Forskalin response even in the presence of lentrunculin. And actually, if you don't have lentrunculin B, it doesn't, it's no different. It looks just the same. So it's become actin independent. And here it's become IH independent. And that effect doesn't depend on any of these things that are being blocked here.
All I was worried about, by looking at it, I remember it as being protein synthesis independent, but it's not, because the thing goes in.
Yeah, now this part, whether you have protein synthesis inhibitors, actually that's another one, present or not, that's a ways back. Coming. There it is. That's the effect of protein synthesis. So you can see, first of all, that here it is coming down slowly, and you can imagine it would drop, but it does indeed drop. After another 20 minutes, it would be down to here. And it's completely unaffected by protein synthesis inhibition. So forskolin has a transient effect and doesn't involve growth. While LTF seems to actually involve what looks like synaptic growth. You actually see active zones develop dense bodies which may help to feed vesicles onto docking sites, is what people imagine these dense bodies do. That's sort of by analogy with the bipolar cells, where the dense bodies really are known to do that. While here that's not clear. So of course, how do IH channels do this? And the answer is, what I would like to do is try to look for IH channel associations with synaptic secretory proteins. Now that's a major undertaking. I suggested this to Suthoff, and he said, which protein? And I said, I have no idea. And he said, if you can't tell me where to start, I'm not going to do this. I mean, this could take me another, 10 man years. But he'll start. The reason he'll start is because Roger Nickel has given me permission to tell you that IH channel blockers block the induction of LTP in CA3 of hippocampus. And that'll get everyone's attention. While this won't. Because who gives a damn about crayfish?
So basically, what it means is that IH is also involved in LTP the same way.
In some way. In CA3. At least part of CA3.
They tried CA1 and they didn't get CA1, or because they just tried CA1?
I think they have looked in CA1, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And of course, they don't know if it's pre or postsynaptic IH channels. They have an opinion.
Are they mossy fibers in CA3?
Yeah, this is mossy fiber LTP, not commissural afferent, not commissural associational LTP.
Do they think it's pre or post?
What do they think?
Yeah.
Well, they think everything is pre in CA3 and post in CA1, and they won't imagine any alternatives. That, of course, is the biggest debate in neurobiology now, over which people are willing to shoot each other. But no one cares about crayfish, so no one's shooting at me.
And another question, is this LTF known in other animal species?
Well, most people don't want to stimulate this way because, especially in cortex, this would be totally unphysiological. This kind, because these cortical cells adapt. Although there are inner neurons in cortex that can do this, but the cells that we like to study, like pyramidal cells, they can't. They could never do this. For that reason, it's never been looked at in the cells that most people study, because the cells can't do it. So you couldn't even stimulate them. They won't follow. And the kinds of inner neurons that can repetitively fire this way are just beginning to be looked at and are much harder to study, much harder to penetrate, much harder. Everything about them is hard. So no one's looked. There it's conceivable because, at least it would be interesting. If you found something like this in a pyramidal cell, what you would have to do is treat the cells in a strange way to allow it to fire this way, because it never would. It would be so unphysiological that it would make you ill. But in neurons which actually can fire like this, it would be more interesting to look, and no one has. And even
excitatory
or inhibitory. There's apparently LTP in inhibitory synapses. So, and you know, one could argue that this is really equivalent to the kind of presynaptic LTP that appears to happen at mossy fibers. We just induce it a different way. It's just that if I wouldn't want to draw that conclusion, because then everyone would say, well, I don't think LTP is sensitive to such and such a kinase, and therefore you're wrong. So I think it's improper to suppose that this is exactly the same as mammalian CA3 LTP. If you want to study mammalian CA3 LTP, it's probably better to do it in the CA3 region of the hippocampus of a mammal rather than the claw of a crayfish. Although it would be a little bit hard to do all of these experiments in that preparation. It was much easier to do it in crayfish. I always pick the easy ones. So, but for sure, this is, as soon as I write these results down and send a copy of the manuscript to Roger Nicol, I'm sure he'll try a lot of this stuff. I've talked to him on the phone, but I didn't tell him what I got yesterday, because I haven't talked to him yesterday. I have only told you.
So Roger Nicol basically knows almost everything. So
he knows most of this, yeah. But just because we've collaborated before, and we remain friends, and we share our secrets. At least I share most of mine, and he apparently shared at least one of his, and even told me, released me from silence.
Well, that means it's going to be really
good. Well, he said not. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess it's, he's been working on it for a while, and apparently it's leaked somehow, so I don't know. Anyhow. I mean, it's the result is only what I just said. These two inhibitors, ZD and DK, both block the induction of mossy fiber LTP, stimulated in a certain way. That's basically all he's got. So
you're closer to having pathways that might be involved.
Yeah, well,
that kinase, for example, and so on, right?
Well, I like to think
you have an unknown,
this is relevant, but I don't
you have
really
an unknown target of calcium. Is that right?
Right. Well, you know, all of this is unknown, since this comes out of a biochemistry review articles. And I mean, this is known if I put down protein synthesis regulation pathways, then everything that doesn't have a question mark is really known. There's a dotted line up there because this one's in dispute. Biochemists can't agree on that one. Everything else here, they agree on, at least according to three review articles. This is my idea, although actually this is very likely to be a target of colliculin, and this is very likely to be, this phosphorylation is very probably reversed by calcium-independent phosphatase. This is a dream. I really don't know, I could do this to almost anywhere in here. I could say that there's a phosphate that inhibits things, and that it's I have to dephosphorylate it to get it to work, and then if I block that phosphatase, I have trouble. I could make that up anywhere, and so putting it here, that's just imagination, and likewise setting this as the calcium target, it's just because I don't see any other calcium targets. So, you know, everybody, the first calcium-dependent enzyme discovered was CAM kinase. And CAM kinase, therefore, it was the most obvious thing to look at in calcium-sensitive processes like LTP. And so the first time there was a CAM kinase inhibitor, someone dumped it on the cortex and blocked LTP, and that happened 15 years ago or so. And well, you know, that's my logic is no better than theirs. That didn't work, but this is the second and only other known calcium-dependent enzyme.
Can you say again what's the magic about IH? Why IH? I mean, where do they get into this picture?
I don't know. So when you ask why, you have to ask God, because I didn't design it. But if you ask how, that's a question that I, in principle, could answer. But I haven't. I don't know how it works. No, it's not calcium influx. It's not the polarization. It's not voltage. It's a protein-protein interaction. I can throw around meaningless words, too. Just a few years ago, you could get a grant just by saying that. But that's a buzzword that means nothing. And if I told you it's stuck to Rab3,
yeah,
would that prove that it's anything?
Do you know that?
No. But you'd like to know, and so would I. I mean, because at this point, any information is a clue that would be helpful. And it is a complete mystery.
Okay.
It really is a... So, I mean, I think that I like to imagine that actin acts as a glue that holds IH in association with its target, which is one of the proteins that can influence secretion. And if you ask which protein do I have in mind, that's silly, because every month a new protein is discovered that when you mutate it, it blocks secretion. So, every month I add a new protein to that list, and what makes me think it's one over another, I have no idea. I have no reason to favor anyone over another.
Well, I guess I'm just asking basic question. How do you go from a voltage-gated channel to...
Well, I don't know. So, and no matter how many times you ask me, I won't know. There's nothing I can do about it. And, no one has any ideas. I have not heard in the times that I've given this talk or earlier versions of this talk. So the first half of the talk has been published, all of it, and some of it, and basically all of it for more than a year in Nature Neuroscience. And in that time, no one has suggested to me how they think it works. Which makes you think, it must all be wrong. It couldn't really be true. That's certainly what I said for the first several months to the people who were getting these results, that they're nuts. But I think now the pattern is overwhelming. So.
Thank you.